Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. This is Chuck here, the home studio of Pond City Market with Noel.
Hey, Chuck. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning. We are, this is our earliest recording yet.
Woo! Feeling it.
Come on, it's 9 o'clock.
No, it's fine. It's good.
Noel just wooed like it was 6:15. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
How about you?
I'm great. I was just reading this New Yorker article when you walked in on Atlanta Monster.
I know. We're really like living with the swells with that show, aren't we?
It's crazy.
Man.
All right. So welcome everybody to, Mini Crush number 5. This week's, we're going to just get right into it. We've got a few segments and this one, first one is a new one. I'm going to call it Hollywood History.
Hollywood History.
How about that?
I like it very much.
So maybe every once in a while, I'll just do a little stuff you should know style short bit on something that I found interesting. And this was certainly that. Story of Peg Entwistle. Do you know who that is, Noel?
There's a bass player with the last name Entwistle from The Who, right?
John Entwistle.
Not the same guy.
No.
No.
This is Peg.
Okay.
And I don't think there was any relation there. In fact, I know there's not. Because Peg was very well known in 1932 for leaping to her death from the H of the Hollywood sign.
Wow.
You ever heard that?
I have not heard that, but that's a high H. That would definitely be a death fall.
That would do it. And so if I'm not mistaken, back then the sign said Hollywood Land. I did not look this part up, so I'm not sure when it switched. But if you didn't know that, it used to say Hollywood Land, the big famous iconic sign in the Hollywood Hills there in Los Angeles. And I think it was like a developer or something. And it wasn't, you know, then the land came down, just became Hollywood.
Have you seen that movie, Hollywood Land?
No, but I wrote a movie years ago called Hollywood Land.
Okay.
Which had nothing to do with the movie that came out called Hollywood Land. But I wrote a movie years ago that never went anywhere. It was not very good, of course. That ended up being sort of like the movie Crash. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
It actually won the Oscar, but wasn't a very good movie.
That's the weird one, right? That everyone loved, and years later it's kind of like, huh.
I like to think it was a better version of Crash, but it had the name Hollywoodland, which later became a movie, so I was kind of like, well, this is clearly not going to go anywhere.
Serendipity.
Because the plot and the title are taken. Anyway, Peg Entwistle in 1932 leapt from the Hollywood sign's H. Some say that area is still haunted today. There are reportings of, I'll get to that actually. But here's Peg's story. There's kind of two parts to this. She, came to Hollywood and she ended up working a little bit. She got a big role in David O. Selznick's 13 Women, but was cut from the final film. Unfortunately, that happens. And the kind of legend goes that she came to Hollywood and did not ever make it as the young starlet that she wanted to be. So she leapt from the H because of that on September 16th, 1932. Beautiful Hollywood actress, grief-stricken, supposedly intoxicated, drunk, I guess, hiked from her uncle's house to the Hollywood sign. And yes, actually, I just see it did say Hollywood Land back then.
And that's a serious hike.
Like, yeah.
To get to that sign is no small task.
Yeah. I mean, and now there are trails. I don't even know what it was like in 1932. But yeah, it's not easy. And, so she hiked from her uncle's house, climbed up the maintenance ladder in the back, and then, leapt to her death. The next day, a female hiker, unidentified, found her body, with a shoe, a jacket, a purse, and a suicide note that said, "I'm afraid. I'm a coward. I'm sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain," P-E, for Peg Entwistle.
Man.
How about that?
It's sad.
So, here's the deal, though. People have said it's been haunted for years, according to legend. The ghost is accompanied by the smell of gardenias, which was her favorite perfume. People say they have smelled that. You know, it's one of those, you know, I don't believe it, but it's one of those stories that you hear.
Smell is a very powerful sense, Chuck.
It is. It is. But here's the truth, actually. It's sort of been rewritten all these years that Peg Entwistle was upset because she didn't make it as a big actress. And while she may not have loved the fact that she was never a big actress, she actually was – today you would probably call her clinically depressed. And who knows? Maybe bipolar. or maybe had some other, you know, some other mental illness going on. It's really easy to paint her as like, oh, she didn't make it in Hollywood, so she leapt to her death. But there was a lot more going on with Peg Entwistle.
Well, and that stuff was largely untreatable or undiagnosed in those days.
Yeah,
right?
She would have been hysterical.
Ah.
A hysterical woman, probably. So back east, as the true story goes, or the more full story, she lived and worked on Broadway, had a decent career on Broadway, actually. When she was 19, she married an older actor. This is kind of interesting. Named Robert Keith. 2 years later, they divorced, and she alleged deception and cruelty. And, cause she found out that he had been previously married and had a 6-year-old son. And that 6-year-old son would grow up to be the actor Brian Keith. So that's a little side note there. So anyway, at the end of the day, it looks like she told her uncle that she was going to step out to buy a book from a drugstore and then to maybe go see some friends, and she disappeared. And, the uncle did say she was always fascinated by that sign, but by all accounts, Peg Entwistle had serious mental problems, most certainly depression. And it was not all just wrapped up in this, starlet never made it as an actor story.
Sounds like her one movie got real bad reviews too, I guess.
I'm sure that doesn't help depression.
She got cut from the studio, I think it looks like.
Right. But her uncle Charles did say that she was depressed, suffering an intense mental anguish. And, I hate it when stories like that are just neatly tied in such a bow that you never really realize that there's probably really something serious going on there.
For sure.
And it wasn't just about the movie industry. So that is Hollywood history for this week. And now we'll just move right on into recommended viewing. As you know, I recommend a foreign film, a documentary film, and an independent film in the recommended viewing segment. And I will start with Not Born in the USA. My foreign film pick for the week is Run, Lola, Run.
I love that movie.
I knew you would have seen that one, Noel.
Years ago. I haven't seen one, but it's such a cool one.
I haven't either. I was kind of just picking through my brain about, I used to watch a lot more foreign films, I think is the deal. And I don't know why I haven't been on that train lately, but I need to get back on it. Run, Lola, Run, the great German film from 1998, directed by Tom Tykwer. It's a thriller. I guess you would call it a thriller. And it stars Franka Potente and Moritz Bleibtreu. And the story is very basic, basically, is right at the very beginning. Lola, this character, gets a call from her boyfriend, Frantic, and she has to get a hold of 100,000 Deutschmarks in 20 minutes to save his life. And when you start a movie like that, you get that clock ticking in such a frantic fashion. It's not like you've got 48 hours, 20 minutes. So it just launches like a cannonball right out of the gate right there.
Does not let up.
And it does not let up. And it tells the story in three different ways. There are three different runs with three different outcomes. And each time she starts over in the same place. And basically, at the end of each run, you know, I won't spoil it, but like I said, there are three different outcomes depending on what happens on her run. So it's got a little bit of a sliding doors quality to it. But it's just like the pace of this movie is just nuts. Yet it doesn't feel like, you know, it's sort of edge of your seat, but it's not exhausting as a viewer.
It's very 90s. It's very like techno soundtrack, and it's almost kind of like an electro Groundhog Day kind of situation, or like Rashomon or something.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, actually. And they call it Run, Lola, Run because, you know, she's got 20 minutes. She spends a lot of this movie running, literally, physically running.
In the Midtown Art Cinema, like on our local movie theater, they have all these foreign posters in the lobby, and one of them is for that. And the German version is just called Lola Rent.
Yeah, Lola Rent. anyway, great movie. Check it out. Next up, we have our documentary, What's Up, Doc? I am going to go with The Kid Stays in the Picture from 2002. This movie from Nanette Bernstein and Brett Morgan is about the life of famed film producer Robert Evans. His history in Hollywood, starting from when he was in a kind of a bad actor by all accounts. He was sort of a rags to riches to rags story because he doesn't make it as an actor, becomes a producer, eventually becomes a studio chief, the head of Paramount Pictures, and then kind of loses it all. And there's a lot involved along the way. And, they focus on his personal relationships, notably his marriage to Ally McGraw, the actress from Love Story, which he produced, very big hit with Ryan O'Neal. He also produced The Godfather. He also produced Chinatown. And Paramount, under his watch, was – those were sort of the golden years of Paramount Pictures in the 1970s when Robert Evans was chief. Have you seen it?
I have not.
Oh, dude.
Didn't you say you went to the premiere of that in L.A.?
Yeah. I think I want to say Paul F. Tompkins in that episode. It wasn't the premiere. I just went on opening night in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard, and it felt like a premiere because there were at least 10 or 12 famous people in that audience.
Yeah.
It was a very highly anticipated movie in the Hollywood community. And it was just visually really compelling, the way they told the story. And people have ripped it off since then. But at the time, you know, documentaries didn't do things like this. It had these animations. You really just got to see it, like almost like cutout animations that tell the story. And Evans narrated it, of course, which is – there's no way it could have been anyone else than Robert Evans telling his own story.
And it's funny, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, sure. There are parts of it that are funny. And he tells the story in a very real way, and he's just got this booming voice, and the way he talks about, you know, making pictures, and he's sort of a throwback. Visually, though, just off the charts as far as what documentaries were doing at the time. You could, like, it had a budget, you know, which is that's the reason most documentaries back then didn't look great, because
of course
it was some kid with a camera,
guerrilla style. That's exactly. Awesome. Let's check that out.
And I think it made a big difference in the kind of budgets that documentaries did get, because they kind of started looking better after Kid Stays in the Picture. Made a lot of money. It was a big hit. And then finally, my Independence Day pick, I'm going to go with The Day Trippers from 1996. I talked very briefly about this on the episode with Guy Branum. Which should be out by now, I think. But if not, look forward to that. And it was written and directed by the wonderful Greg Mottola. And I think it was his first movie. Little small indie. It was a very simple story. It's a story about a woman who finds a letter that indicates that her husband may be cheating on her. So she decides to pile in the car in the station wagon with her sister, her sister's boyfriend, and her parents, and go from Long Island into the city of Manhattan to do a little spying and find that out. Very simple story, just a delightful, fun movie. The woman is Hope Davis. Stanley Tucci is her husband. Parker Posey is her sister. Liev Schreiber is her boyfriend. And her mom and dad are the great Ann Mara and Pat McNamara. Also, Campbell Scott is in it, and it's just so funny. It's just one of these movies that really captures, family so well, because their whole family is kind of playing detective in Manhattan, snooping around his office, trying to find out if he's cheating on her. And, just a very, very delightful, fun movie. The Day Trippers from 1996. Go check it out. All right. And we finish up with, Stream This and Comment Card. I am going to go for streaming this. It's a bit of a cheat because it's an HBO show and you don't exactly stream that. Although I guess you can.
You can buy the a la carte now, I think. You don't even have to have a subscription. There's the HBO Now or whatever.
HBO Go. You can just buy.
HBO Go. You can just buy now. You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, good for them. High Maintenance season 2. Do you watch this show?
This is the weed delivery show.
Yes.
Yeah. I've seen a little bit of it.
All right. So how this show started was, it started as a web series, which I watched. I can't remember who sent it to me, but someone sent it to me. And I watched the web series. They were shorts. I feel like they were about 6 or 7 minutes long and just told like one little piece of a story. And then I found out it was from husband-wife team Ben Sinclair and Katja Blichfeld. And I'll finish up with their story in a second. But they got signed by HBO to do the series, and I was super stoked because – it's just such a good, the web shorts were so great. And, to be picked up by HBO was just obviously a huge, huge deal for them. HBO didn't have a habit of picking up random web shows about weed delivery guys. and you know, that's the easiest way to describe it. It's about a weed delivery guy in New York City, but it's really not about a weed delivery guy. He happens to do that. It's about New York City and the stories of the people of New York City.
Well, it's a perfect frame story for telling that kind of stuff. You know, you
absolutely
get to just different character every episode.
Yep.
You know, seeing the landscape as he's biking around, I believe, you know.
Yep. It's probably the most accurate portrayal of modern New York that I've seen, because it tells the stories of everyone. And you're right. That's the great thing about the We Delivery Guy. One episode, and in each episode now, the 30-minute version weaves together two or three different stories. So one, he might visit a high-powered stockbroker in Wall Street, and then he bikes over to like a young Cuban girl in a tenement apartment. And all these stories kind of weave together somehow a lot of times. And a lot of times he is the through line for how they weave together. But it's got so much heart, and it's real, and it can be heartbreaking and sad or funny. It's just really, really awesome. And the reason I said I'll finish up about their marriage, they actually, Ben Sinclair, who stars in the movie, they don't even name him. He's just Weed Guy or the guy. And his wife was behind the scenes writing and directing along with him. They actually got divorced before season two and decided to, you know, they got divorced. She is now living with her new girlfriend, and they're all friends. And he was like, you know, that kind of life happens. It was rough, but we have a good thing going here with the show. And they decided to keep making the show together through season two.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really interesting that they can make that work like that. And so hats off to them. I'm trying to get Ben Sinclair on the show, and I've actually been in touch with HBO. And it may be possible. The problem is I'm going to New York at the end of February, and I was trying to land him there, but he's in LA through February. But it sounds like it's possible. So I'm going to make it happen at some
point. Heck yeah. It's awesome.
The character that he plays is just such a sweet guy. He always just wants to do right by people, in whatever situation he's launched into. Mm-hmm. He always just has a good heart and wants to do the right thing. And he's just one of the beloved characters on TV to me.
It's interesting too, because I think people have a perceived idea of like what kinds of people buy marijuana.
Marijuana. Or,
yeah. What you realize in the show is that like it's every kind of person.
It is every kind of person. Yeah. Exactly. And that is certainly not the focus of the show, but that ends up sort of bleeding through for sure. So High Maintenance season two, check out season one. And I believe on HBO, they had they have the web shorts up there too, and I recommend all of them. And it's kind of funny, if you watch the web shorts, some of those characters later appear on various episodes, and sometimes it'll be like a girlfriend who later ends up with a different boyfriend, and he'll be like, "Wait a minute, didn't I know you from the other place?"
Sure.
And so it's kind of cool how they do that. All right, and now we finish with comment card, listener mail from you guys. And I specifically asked for questions for me and Noel on this one. You ready, Noel?
I am.
This is from Avalon Rector. Great name.
Very intense name.
Reboots. Huh. What are they good for? Absolutely nothing? Or is it just a basic desire to see things we have created before through the lens of our new technology? What are your thoughts, guys? I'll let you go first here.
I think it just depends on the reboot, right? Like, some of them are such obvious cash grabs that you can't help but just be offended by it, especially if you have like a special place in your heart for the original. I'm speaking in generalizations here. Like, for example, there's the Ocean's 11 reboot that's coming out with all women. I think that's interesting and could be, if handled well, a good thing. You know, that franchise is so kind of open-ended anyway that it's not like a remake. It's just kind of like we're going to resuscitate this concept of a group of people doing a heist. I'm all about stuff like that.
Right.
But then if you have like, you know, for example, there's a Heathers TV show.
Oh, really?
And it looks like utter trash. It just it's like this modern reboot of Heathers in a TV show form.
Uh-huh.
And it looks just like offensive and just really crass. And I know the original is crass as well, but it's got, you know, it's got class. It's classy crass, you know, but this just looks really, really bad. It replaces characters from the originals with kind of more modern versions. It just looks like kind of a gross Glee kind of, you know.
Oh, interesting.
So that bothers me, stuff like that, you know.
All right, my take is I'm kind of throwing remakes and reboots into the same bucket, even though I know they're a little different. When it comes to like, here's our third version of Spider-Man, it gets a little tiresome to me, and that feels like just, hey, let's just try and print some money for the studio. Let's not be original. Having said that, the latest iteration of Spider-Man with the young kid is great. I really thought it was really good.
And that was a lot of studio weirdness with like owning the rights and Sony versus Marvel or whatever.
Exactly.
And now Marvel has it and they can do whatever they want with the character. So I think that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess like that middle version with Andrew Garfield, I didn't care for at all. So maybe that was the problem is just throw those movies out and keep 1 and 2 of Tobey Maguire because the third one wasn't great. I think they just... You're right. Like a lot of times it feels like a cash grab or just ill-conceived. Like, you know, one of my most beloved movies of all time, the great comedy Arthur with Dudley Moore, you know, when they remade that with Russell Brand.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't even see it, you know, because I knew. I was like, this is not going to be good.
But is that a remake or a reboot? Like, is that like...
That's a remake.
Okay.
Yeah, straight up remake.
So reboots are more about like franchises maybe or...
Yeah, I mean... they're doing it with TV now too, like Roseanne comes back or Will and Grace comes back. And my whole thing is just there's so many good writers out there, so many great ideas. Mm. Have you heard of the Blacklist in LA, the list of screenplays that don't get
– Oh, no, no. Is this a podcast?
No, there's something – it's been around for years. They put it – I can't remember what organization puts it out, but there's something called the Blacklist where the best unproduced screenplays each year are put on a list. And like there are great ideas, there are great original ideas out there. It's not like for all of Hollywood's history, they had great new ideas and then writers just dried up and they couldn't do it. So they started remaking everything. It has nothing to do with that. So why make Heathers again when you can just do another story about high school if you want?
Because it worked once. And then,
well,
like,
that's,
you know,
exactly.
What I mean?
Yeah. It's lazy.
Yeah,
yeah. It's studio chiefs and studio heads. Doing the laziest thing possible. That's what I think. Yeah. Having said that, some of these movies can be okay, but, and I just feel bad. There's so many good, great ideas out there that don't get made. Just be more original. Great question, Avalon. Great name. Number 2 of 3, Catherine Williams. What is your opinion on, well, no, we get right back into it. What's your opinion on male lead movies being turned into all female lead movies like Ghostbusters and Ocean's 8? I'll go first on this one. This sort of ties in with the reboot. In a way, I'm kind of like, eh. But in these cases, I think is so important for, especially when you're talking about recasting with an all-female cast, and so important that the young women and girls see these movies and be and can be represented. Like when I saw some of the so I can't remember, someone sent me a video of the Ghostbusters reaction from these young girls, and it was just amazing to see these girls like identifying with these characters finally in a way that they couldn't before. And like, I don't see how you can watch that and say like that's not a good thing.
I think, unfortunately, that movie wasn't very good. But
I thought it was okay.
Yeah. I saw it with my kid. And she liked it. My daughter is 9 now, and it was 8 at the time. She enjoyed it quite a lot. It didn't knock her socks off the way some things have. But
right.
I totally see the good behind doing that. But it's also like, let's just, to your previous point, let's just make more original stories with badass female leads.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's true. And here's my dirty little secret and stuff you should know, fans. I know that this is largely who's listening. You're going to be so mad at me. I don't think the original Ghostbusters was the greatest thing since sliced bread either.
Whoa. Whoa. Gauntlet thrown down.
Do you love it?
I do. I do. Yeah.
I mean, I certainly liked it, but when I go back and watch it now, it's not the funniest thing in the world. Like, the funniest parts are just Bill Murray goofing around.
I think their chemistry is really fun and great. You know, I enjoy that. Though I haven't seen it in a long time, so maybe it won't hold up for me, but I...
No, I mean, I liked it, but it's put on this pedestal, like, especially the blowback that the lady version got from a bunch of dudes. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, they put Ghostbusters, the original, on a pedestal that it's like, you know, the greatest film ever made, and how dare put women in those suits? And I'm just like, come on, man. Seriously? Put women in those suits.
Do whatever you want. Just make a good movie. That's all I'm saying.
And I think I think the new Ocean's 8 looks awesome.
Of course, definitely. And is Soderbergh involved or not?
I don't know. I bet he's producing in some capacity.
Yeah. I think he's directed all of them thus far, I believe.
Oh, really?
I think so.
I like that first one a lot. That was a good remake. All right, and finally, Matthew Moyle. And thanks, Catherine, for that question. Matthew Moyle, which is more important to you in a film, the technical aspects like cinematography and editing, or the artistic aspects like plot and acting? Matthew, that is a great question, and it's a total cop-out, because I'm going to say both, all of it. A great movie is all of those things coming together and holding hands to make a great film. The technical aspects, like if you're, well, I was about to say if you're missing half, then it's probably not going to be a great movie. I will say this, a wonderfully technical movie can never be great if the, what you call artistic aspects are not great. However, if the artistic aspects are great, then you can get away with the technical aspects not being as great. Case in point, a lot of like really low budget indie movies that didn't have a lot to work with, they can't make it look like a Roger Deakins shot picture, can still be great, great movies.
Absolutely. It reminds me of a quote that I'm going to paraphrase from that recent batshit interview with Quincy Jones. He talks about, like, I don't care if you have the greatest singer on the planet and the best studio musicians. If you don't have a song, you don't have a song.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think you can apply that to film as
well.
Yeah,
you can't polish a turd.
Yeah,
that's another, the old saying.
Another good one, yeah.
But to me, to make for all cylinders to be firing, that's when you're really cooking with gas,
sure.
My dad used to say.
Oh, yeah.
Looks great, sounds great, great acting, great story. But it all comes down to that story, man.
But like we talked about last week with like that movie Tangerine, you can make a great movie on an iPhone. And, you know, iPhones look
true.
Pretty good. But like,
yeah,
that's very low-fi by today's standards. But if you have the acting and the story, the
yep.
technical stuff is a little less important, kind of. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, Chuck, what is on the docket for Friday's episode?
Are you talking about the homework assignment?
Whatever you want to call it, man. I don't know your code words.
Yeah, homework, everybody, this week is to watch well, good for you. It's to watch Waiting for Guffman. That's homework I don't mind giving out.
And then you have to read Waiting for Godot and write a report and submit it via email to moviecrush@howstuffworks.com.
Right, to make it real homework.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting for Guffman, the great Christopher Guest mockumentary, which hopefully everybody has seen. If not, just get ready, because it's one of the great, great funny movies of all time. And I had, in New York City, the wonderful and charming Brooke Adams of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Dead Zone and Days of Heaven.
Oh, wow.
And some of like the great movies of the 70s and 80s.
Classic pictures.
And Tony Shalhoub's wife. So it's no surprise why she was in there. I recorded them back to back.
Very well done, Chuck.
Yeah, so watch Waiting for Guffman coming up this Friday with Brooke Adams. And we appreciate you guys tuning in this week for the Mini Crush. Thanks a lot.
See ya.